Well, this morning, in this second hour of Focus, we'll be talking about the West Nile virus. Now, this is a virus that has commonly been found in Africa, in West Asia, and in the Middle East. It can cause a brain inflammation called encephalitis, which can be severe, even fatal, the greatest risk being to people over 50. Until recently, this virus, the West Nile virus, had not been seen in North America, but now it has made an appearance, the first cases being seen in New York City in the summer of 1999. It appeared again last year, demonstrating that it could overwinter, and it does seem to be spreading, leading some scientists to predict that within a few years it could be found over most of the United States. This morning we'll be talking with the scientist who was instrumental in identifying this in New York, about a little bit about West Nile, but also some of the issues raised. And there are some important ones raised by this particular disease and the and what it took to try to figure out what was going on in New York. Our guest is Tracy McNamara. She is a veterinarian. She works with the Wildlife Conservation Society in the Bronx, New York. She's a graduate of Cornell. She got her vet med degree there. She is also a visiting assistant professor in pathology at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine of Yeshiva University in the Bronx, and is here visiting the campus to talk a little bit about this West Nile virus and its implications for veterinary and for public health preparedness. This is a talk in the MillerCom series. All of these always open and free to the public. We've had a lot of these speakers on here on Focus 580 so that folks who couldn't attend the talks can still hear what they have to say. So, but of course, if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana and you're interested in hearing our speaker, you can do that. She'll be talking at 4 o'clock this afternoon in room 180 of Bevere Hall on the campus. So you certainly can stop by. But we're happy to have you here. And if you have questions, you can always call in and ask them. She'll do her best to give you an answer. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you can give us a call. All we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so we can keep things moving along and include as many callers as possible. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. Pleasure
first,
to be here.
I guess maybe we should talk a little bit about the mechanics of West Nile, what it is we're talking about. This is it's a virus that does indeed can infect human beings, and it involves birds and mosquitoes. So,
and horses.
And other, I guess, other animals as well.
Yeah. Basically, since this is the first time this virus has occurred in this hemisphere, I think we have to be very cautious about making predictions, because when a virus reaches a completely new environment, it's difficult to predict what it will or won't do.
Mm-hmm.
And everything this virus has done has already come as a surprise. As you said, it overwintered, even though everyone had said it would not. It successfully overwintered in mosquitoes in New York City. Everyone said we wouldn't see cases in the winter. We did. Predictions were made based on risk analysis maps that the virus would spread south. And last summer, although it did that, first it spread north up to the Canadian border. And I think the words to live by is if West Nile has taught us anything, is it's imperative that everyone in the medical, veterinary, and public health field continue to challenge their assumptions. And any predictions that are made in the absence of data will most likely be proven wrong.
Just the most recent story that I've seen about this was just within the last few days. I think it was in the story that I looked at was in the Washington Post that had said that various people around the country have been looking. They've been trying to see, can they find it here this year in 2001? And so far, at least as I remember, where the story said, no one has found any yet. Now, is that true? Or is that, should we also say, well, one shouldn't get a false sense of security just because we haven't found any yet?
Oh, absolutely. I thought you were, they just had a major international conference on West Nile in New York around 10 days ago. And in that meeting, perhaps one of the more sobering points that was made by the New York State Department of Health, who, having lived through two summers of West Nile virus, last summer, you know, spent a fortune and put tremendous energy into using all of the traditional surveillance methods that one would use for a mosquito-borne viral infection. And bottom line is none of them worked. None of them were predictive of human risk. And this summer, the best thing we have to go on is people picking up the phone and calling in and saying they've seen dead birds. My concern with that is an entirely passive system and sort of like one of those Zen, you know, mind benders. You know, if a crow dies in a forest and no one's there to see it and no one picks up the phone, do you have West Nile virus? It's completely dependent on public participation.
Well, and one of the things that I understand is, I guess, the issue of how it is that the disease managed to overwinter is that there's one particular kind of mosquito that's best at transmitting it, and it's a kind of a mosquito that during the wintertime finds warm places to go, and it actually hibernates.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no. I'm sure that it would be very difficult, even if you decided, well, we're going to go out and we're going to try to get rid of all those mosquitoes, to find all of the places that those mosquitoes could be over the wintertime.
Yeah, no one is suggesting that that's even feasible. The point of spraying would be to try and knock down the numbers of adult feeding mosquitoes and lessen human risk. The thing is, though, the problem with spraying is we now know there are at least six species of mosquitoes that are involved and can successfully transmit West Nile virus. They all have very different biologies. They're all active at different times of the day or night. They live in different areas. So how do you target your spraying when we, as of yet, still do not know which mosquito serves as a primary vector for transmitting disease to humans?
Oh, I guess I thought that there was one species that had been...
Well, Culex pipiens is what everyone was saying. However, Culex pipiens is not active in June. And in the first summer, birds were dying at the end of June and in July. People didn't die until August. But in the second summer of West Nile, the same thing happened. We had active cases in June, and that led people to look for different vectors.
Let me introduce again, just real quick here, our guest, Tracy McNamara, is head of pathology with the Wildlife Conservation Society in New York City, in the Bronx, and was very much involved in identifying the presence of West Nile virus in New York City in the summer of 1999. And as we mentioned at the beginning of the program, this was something that had been seen before in Africa, in West Asia, in the Middle East, but never in North America until that point. And she's since that time has written many papers and done an awful lot of speaking on this subject, and we're really pleased to have her here on the show. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Let's go back to talk a little bit about what happened in that summer of 99. Two things happened that people noticed, but of course, that I imagine there would have been different kinds of people. Earlier in that summer, something was obviously wrong with the birds, crows particularly. They were obviously seen to be sick, although there was no visible signs of wounds. They were obviously behaving so that they were not well. Then later that summer, you started to see people turning up, particularly, I guess, elderly people turning up in hospitals with these symptoms that at some point someone said, well, this kind of looks like encephalitis to us. And I guess that then kind of at the beginning they said, well, we know we have St. Louis encephalitis in this country. We've seen it here in Illinois, in southern Illinois. So though that probably is what it is, then eventually we get to the point where we figured out, no, this is something that we've never seen before. Was it the fact that did you get involved in this because of the birds initially?
Yes. You see, and that's the irony of the situation. Crows have been dying since late June, early July. They were seen by a small animal veterinary practitioner who then sent those crows up, since they were wild birds. They fell under the jurisdiction of the Department of Environmental Conservation, which in New York State has jurisdiction over free-ranging wildlife. The individual there who was doing analysis has no formal training in veterinary pathology and was basically not coming up with accurate diagnoses. When birds started showing up dead on the grounds of the Queen Zoo near our exhibits, the curators sent material for that same reason to the DEC, and again, we were waiting for a diagnosis. When they started showing up on the grounds of the Bronx Zoo, we're always concerned about the possibility of free-ranging wildlife introducing disease to our captive collections. And I think there is very much a different mindset with free-ranging wildlife versus captive zoo wildlife. When you're dealing with endangered species, every individual counts. 400 dead crows with no diagnosis is simply not acceptable. So when a few crows started showing up on the grounds of the Bronx Zoo, where we have a complete department of pathology, we launched our own investigation. And what I saw after doing complete postmortems, necropsies, and histopathology, and bacteriology, and toxicology, led me to believe that what I was seeing in the crows, encephalitis, myocarditis, and what I ultimately saw in the zoo birds was the same. And based on my years of experience as a comparative pathologist and the fact that I was in a unique situation, I was the only one looking at these crows who had the advantage of also having domestic poultry right on zoo, in our children's zoo, and they were fine. So if this had been a regular avian virus, something that normally kills birds, well, logically, it should have been killing the chickens and the turkeys, but they were okay. So that put the major, you know, poultry disease is way low on the list from a logical point of view. And when I made the intuitive leap that there might be a connection between the birds and the people who were dying of supposed St. Louis encephalitis, according to people in the public health field, that was an outlandish suggestion, because in the textbooks, all the known mosquito-borne viruses of this hemisphere have co-evolved with birds over eons. And birds are asymptomatic reservoirs. They don't get sick. They don't die. But the fact was, the irrefutable fact was, I had barrels of dead birds. They were mostly northern and southern hemisphere species of birds. And they had encephalitis. And it did not appear to fit any of the known veterinary diseases. And I have training in foreign animal disease recognition. I did a course at Plum Island, the Foreign Animal Disease Diagnostic Lab in Long Island. And it just didn't seem to fit anything. And the reason I was able to say, well, what if, you know, let's just put aside the diagnosis of St. Louis for a moment, or let's just assume maybe it's a new strain of St. Louis. The reason I was able to do that is because I work in a zoo, and the area of zoo and wildlife pathology is very much a frontier, mm-hmm. because there are so few of us who are doing it in the United States. There are only 7 zoos in the U.S. with full-time pathologists on staff. And so for that reason, every single day when I see a dead animal, we have to rule out everything that's known. But since we're pioneers, we know that we could be seeing something for the very first time. So we are not threatened or intimidated by the unexpected, the unknown. In fact, looking for it is my job definition. Yeah. And so I was like, you know, forget what's in the textbooks. All I can tell you is what I'm seeing under the microscope. And when we sent material off to the National Veterinary Lab and they isolated the virus, and when they did electron microscopy and could see the viral particles from my birds, the fact that they were a given size, 40 nanometers diameter, was historic. That made history. That proved that we did have a flaviviral infection. It was killing birds, and it could be related to what was going on in people. Up until that moment, no flaviviral infections had been reported to kill birds.
Hmm. Is this something that you think is going to be, in addition to being a threat to human population, that for some time to come, is this a serious problem for the bird populations of this country?
Oh, yeah. This has been a real veterinary and a wildlife disaster. And the irony is, once people realized that the birds, in fact, did serve as sentinels, at the recent meeting, I had to point out to those people in public health who said, okay, we want dead birds because they're the only indication of viral activity. It's like, gee, I hate to burst your bubble, but, you know, there are some people like veterinarians and wildlife biologists who don't want dead birds, and we're working very hard on a vaccine. And if we have anything to say about it, you're not going to have a lot of dead birds dropping from the sky. So I think you better start looking at another surveillance system. And that just goes to show, really, that there continues to be a disconnect between the wildlife community, the domestic animal veterinary community and the public health community. And that is the lesson to be learned from West Nile. That's one that we need to bridge.
Do you also think that some of those people who have made predictions about the continued spread of the disease may be correct? That is, given enough time, maybe a couple of years, it's possible that we would see this now over large parts of the country or most of the country?
Basically, there's nothing to stop it from spreading. Everywhere, this is a new virus looking for a home, and everywhere it goes is going to look for new vectors, new reservoir hosts. Someone made a prediction that everywhere it goes, it'll continue to kill horses, birds, people, and frankly, we don't know what else, because our current surveillance system is so focused, given our limited amount of funding. There are many research questions out there that remain to be addressed, but there's simply nothing we can do about it right now.
I'm interested in hearing some more about what the surveillance system, what constituted the, or constitutes the surveillance system. One of the things that I read about was apparently there were flocks of chickens.
Well, yes, they used
for that.
Yeah. Traditionally, especially in this neck of the woods where you've had St. Louis encephalitis, chickens are used because they will bleed them every week, and chickens can become infected with St. Louis encephalitis. They will mount an antibody response. You can prove that with a blood test, and it could be an early indicator that you have, you know, mosquitoes spreading the virus in that area. The problem was the chickens didn't work in New York City. We don't know if it's because we didn't know where to place those chickens, whether the chickens are just really lousy sentinels for West Nile, and maybe we need to be looking at alternative species like the sparrow. And those studies are underway.
So then what is the best that you can do is be on the lookout for dead birds, and then when you find them, try to figure out what killed them?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And the irony is, though, now that this is probably one of the biggest attempts to go out and do a massive survey on wildlife, but just as when St. Louis was diagnosed, it was because that's all we were looking for. Well, now we're doing the exact same thing, only now all we're looking for is West Nile virus. Mm-hmm. So if they happen to have Eastern equine encephalitis or St. Louis encephalitis or something else we don't know is out there, we're going to miss it. And my concern is the way this diagnosis was made was based on just good old-fashioned pathology where, you know, systematic evaluation of every tissue, every bird. We kept a very open mind, and we didn't put blinders on. Whatever this was, we were going to figure it out, but we didn't assume that we knew what the answer was, and we didn't restrict our investigation to a single diagnosis that we were targeting. And we're doing the very same thing now with West Nile again.
Our guest this morning, Dr. Tracy McNamara. She works with the Wildlife Conservation Society in the Bronx, New York. She is a veterinary pathologist. In addition, she also teaches at, she's visiting assistant professor in pathology at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx, and is here visiting the campus to talk about this very topic, about West Nile virus and what it should mean to us, how we should think about this on, in a public health kind of a way. She's giving a talk in the MillerCom series. That's today, 4 o'clock this afternoon, in room 180 of Bevere Hall. So if you'd like to hear more about that, you can attend. And here, if you have questions, you can call. We have one person here ready to go. Others are welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. Around Illinois, Indiana, anywhere the signal will travel, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Well, I just tuned in and I heard that this virus might also kill horses, and I have a few. So I'm interested in learning how and what happens when the horse gets this virus then.
Yes, it does kill horses, and it has a pretty high fatality rate. And if you want information on that, if you have access to a computer, the best website would be if you went to the USDA website, usda.gov.
Okay.
They will have an entire West Nile virus section and complete information on what we know about this virus to date in horses. Mm-hmm. It causes neurologic signs. Some horses recover, but some don't. Mm-hmm. At this stage, we still have no treatment, no vaccine, no cure. A vaccine, an experimental vaccine, is underway, and you know, that may be available. It'll certainly be available before we have one for humans. So that's the good news. Well, hey, when you're talking about racehorses, the private funding is made available to do that kind of research.
But it has happened then on the East Coast?
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes. And the best advice that anyone can give you at this stage is mosquito reduction. Mm-hmm. Look at where you have your horses. Get rid of all the, garbage or, soda cans or spare tires, anything that might serve as a mosquito breeding habitat. That's something every citizen can and should be doing in Illinois. Mm-hmm. And take that responsibility upon yourself, because that's not something your local health department will be able to do. Other than that, I don't have really. I'd have to defer to the USDA for recommendations.
Well, that's good. Thank you for the reference.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions again are welcome. 333-WILL, toll free 800-222-WILL. According to what I read there, there has been a vaccine tested for Japanese encephalitis, which is supposed to be similar to that that's caused by West Nile. And maybe some people think that would work. You're shaking your head. How close are we to having a vaccine for West Nile encephalitis?
Well, actually, as far as the Japanese encephalitis goes, we did a research project on that with the National Wildlife Health Center, USGS, out in Madison, Wisconsin, because after the first summer, we knew we were going into another summer of West Nile, and we still had outdoor birds, and we had birds that had not seroconverted that were susceptible, and we were looking for anything that might provide protection to the birds in our care. At Madison, they did a crow trial. He had, I think, 10 crows. 4 of them survived. Well, it was better than 100% fatality. However, when we did a similar vaccine study in birds that represented 4 different orders of birds in the zoo, we had, a duck and a pheasant, and simply what we did was we administered the vaccine. We tried to see if they mounted any kind of immune response that would be protective against Japanese encephalitis or West Nile virus, and unfortunately, neither occurred. So we did not use Japanese encephalitis as the vaccine. There's also an issue called immune enhancement that is of concern. That really, I'd have to defer to arbovirologists, but there's a concern that vaccination with one kind of arbovirus may make you more susceptible to serious effects when you're re-exposed to another one. So there were pros and cons for trying to do that, and then ultimately, as I said, it didn't work.
And arboviruses, these are the ones that are transmitted by mosquitoes.
Yes, right? Arthropod-borne just means mosquito-borne or any other arthropod.
Right. And so the idea is that then if you, instead of helping you, giving the vaccine actually might mean that if you were then exposed to it, you would be worse off than you
possibly
would otherwise.
Possibly. Maybe. It's a theoretical concern by people who know a lot more about arboviruses than I do. As far as the what we are hoping will happen, this recombinant DNA vaccine that's been developed by researchers at CDC and in combination with the Colorado State University and some military folks, we believe the vaccine works. We think it'll be available, like I said, far sooner than any human vaccine. We are now going to be doing controlled trials in birds to see if it also protects birds. And that'll happen within the next few weeks. If it works, we're hoping to at least have an injectable vaccine that will protect endangered species by this summer. Long term, we hope to create, the people who are working on this, Mike Bunning and Dr. Jeff Chang, they hope to create a bird seed delivery vaccine. Now, that may sound crazy, but the intention would be to decrease the amount of birds in the environment that have enough virus to infect mosquitoes. The fact is, you can't eliminate mosquitoes. You can't eliminate birds. if we can knock down the numbers and interrupt the transmission of virus to humans and to other birds, then we'll have done something.
Yeah, okay. And it sounds like it's a better alternative than actually trying to go out and spray and kill mosquitoes.
Yeah, well, the other thing that's recently come to light, experimental work done at the National Wildlife Health Center has proven that there is direct bird-to-bird transmission of this virus in the absence of mosquitoes.
So even if you got rid of the mosquitoes.
Yeah, it's sort of like, well, you can blast the world with pesticides, but if there's direct spread, are you going to be free of West Nile virus? You may not get human infections, but that doesn't mean it isn't going to continue to spread throughout the country. And just at last week's meeting, Dr. McLean announced that he was able to successfully infect crows by feeding them infected mice. So the oral transmission occurs. That raises a lot of questions about scavengers. Is that why crows were dying at such high numbers? Because that's what they do. Is that why we were seeing so many hawks and eagles that were dying from the virus? Is it because they were eating infected passerine birds? Many, many questions that remain to be answered. And basically, until we are able to do that kind of research, you really can't make predictions about this virus because how can you predict what you don't understand?
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have some other callers. We'll go to, again, here, Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello. Hello?
Yes.
My question is, if you find a dead bird in your yard, how should you handle it and who should you call?
My understanding is, at least in New York City, and from what I understand, I believe every health department in the United States has received funding from the CDC to become part of the National West Nile Surveillance Initiative. At least in New York, they have a hotline that people can use to call and report that they have found a dead bird. I'm certain your health department is looking into doing something similar, and so I would recommend that you call your local health department and ask them what protocols they are putting into place for this spring and summer.
Good. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. And what are the chances that a human being could get this by handling a dead bird?
The recommendations have been, from the very beginning, don't pick them up with bare hands. I wouldn't do that with anything. They have lots of other diseases. We still don't know, really, what the actual potential health risk may be. These birds are they have an intense amount of virus. We know that's shed through the kidneys and the GI tract. We don't know what risk that may pose for the public, but I would urge people to take caution and certainly not to handle birds except through a plastic bag. And whatever your local health department recommends, that's what I would do.
Okay. Next caller is in Savoy, line one. Hello.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
Hey, I was just wondering, how does this really compare to... the disasters going on in England with hoof and mouth disease. Is it something that could be monumental in nature, or is it just something that is, really of interest?
Oh, no. I think we are a long way from knowing what the ultimate effects of West Nile virus will be in this country because there are so many variables we do not yet understand. We don't know what will happen when this virus comes up to gets into other mosquito populations. We don't know what will happen when it reaches areas where you have endemic St. Louis encephalitis activity. We don't know if the virus may naturally recombine with some other virus that's out there in nature. That's something RNA viruses like to do. There are just so many unknowns about this. Basically, we don't know what's going to happen. As far as how this compares with the foot and mouth outbreak in England, the same lesson of, I think the whole world still thinks of disease in the way we did in the 1920s. I think it's like wishful thinking that, these disasters that take place are only going to take place in the movies. But in fact, if you look at the way people and animals move throughout the world today, any disease can be anywhere within 8 hours. It's only a plane ride away. We don't fumigate planes. We don't fumigate ships. We have, you know, millions of people passing through our airports every single day that could have landed, come across from the other side of the world, be incubating a virus, and boom, there they are. The same thing applies for the way we move animals and the fact that we keep them in an intensive management situations. And one infected animal, you can have animals in the four corners of the world 8 hours later because of the way we move these animals for agriculture and for sale.
Yeah, I was just, you know, obviously, you know, this virus comes from, you know, northern Africa and in that area, and that seems like the logical place to go study it. And you don't really hear people screaming, you know, that the world's going to end because of it.
No, but actually, if you look at West Nile virus outbreaks, the reason this has been relatively unstudied is back in the 60s and 50s, there were only sporadic outbreaks. But in the past decade, these viruses are picking up speed. The outbreak in Romania, the outbreaks in Israel, the outbreaks in Russia, the outbreak in France. This is no longer, oh, you see it once every 10 years. And in fact, the outbreak in Israel had much higher human fatality, as did the one in Romania. The people who are experts in this area are concerned. We are utterly unprepared in the United States to deal with mosquito-borne diseases. The field of medical entomology has all but disappeared. New York City didn't have a mosquito control program because, well, we'd never had a problem. So how do you justify spending that money? This could just as easily have been yellow fever or Rift Valley fever. And I think there's a certain wishful thinking that if we don't recognize it, we don't have to deal with it and we don't have to worry about it. But
yeah.
In fact, I think we should be worrying about not just this disease, but many others.
Yeah, I just, you know, I understand your point of view and everything, and this, you know, these threats have been with us for many, many, many years, and
But this is a particularly virulent strain of West Nile. This is not like any old arbovirus. This is not like St. Louis encephalitis. Experimental studies done comparing the two viruses in sparrows and blue jays show there is absolutely no way you can compare those two viruses in birds.
Yeah. How much money do you think you need to stop it?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, I don't know that it's so much money as just interpersonal relationships. The problem we had with West Nile is that it was the first time in this nation that a disease respected no boundaries. It was spread by birds and mosquitoes. The birds happened to be wild birds, so that was under the federal government, the USGS. The fact that it killed horses, well, that involved the USDA. And the fact that it killed people, that involved CDC and the public health authorities. None of those groups had ever really talked to each other. And, you know, that was one of the major stumbling blocks. And there's really, in the congressional investigation that pursued, published on this, their conclusion was that our government was utterly unprepared for a zoonotic disease. And that is still a major problem.
That was an interesting situation. It's nice talking to you.
All thanks.
Right, thanks for the call. As you point out, the level of mobility that we have in the world now facilitates transmission of disease to a degree that we just haven't seen in the past. One of the questions about West Nile that I guess nobody's really got an answer for is, we said at the beginning of the program, before 1999, we'd never seen it in North America. One of the questions is, well, how did it get here?
Well, actually, you know, when this first happened, everybody said, well, could it have been a bioterrorist event?
Mm-hmm.
I was like, well, you'll never know, because unless it's a bioengineered strain with a special little tag on it that says, you know, manufactured in Iraq, you're never going to know. And that goes for basically any naturally occurring virus. Also, because there was such a delay in diagnosis, you know, it's impossible to backtrack 3 months and figure out whether a mosquito came in from, a used tire that we imported from Japan, which is how Aedes japonicus and Aedes albopictus were introduced to this country. We don't know whether it stepped off a plane in terms of a passenger who had been in Israel and had a sufficient viremia to infect mosquitoes. We don't know if it came in with a smuggled bird. Basically, we don't know. The way the virus could have gotten into the country, I mean, they're too numerous to list.
Mm.
It's not a question of how it got in here, but basically, was it here before? And the most sobering part of this whole experience for me has been realizing that that our surveillance system for biologic agents in the United States is quite lacking. I don't know if people realize, but back in the 60s, most people who died received a postmortem, so you could establish a cause of death. Well, in today's world with HMOs and it costs $2,000 to do a postmortem, now less than 10% of people who die actually get investigated. So I'm like, well, so what's the body count? When do you decide you have a problem? You know, how many people have to be in the street before someone actually tries to establish an etiologic diagnosis? And that's something that still hasn't been addressed.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest, Dr. Tracy McNamara. She is a veterinary pathologist. She works with the Wildlife Conservation Society in New York, in the Bronx, and was very important in identifying the presence of the West Nile virus in New York City in the summer of 1999, which, as we've said a couple of times, was a virus that was found other places in the world, Africa, the Middle East, but until then had not been identified in the United States. She's here to give a talk in the MillerCom series. That's later today. But here, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Have a couple of champagne callers here. The next person is line two.
Yes, I'm an ornithologist, and my first bit is an observation, and that is that we have a tremendous amount of neotropical migrants that spend their winters in the southern hemisphere and their summers in the northern hemisphere. So the amount of border that you have to protect from Asian diseases or from new diseases from the old world that are mediated by birds is much bigger than just the boundaries of the United States.
Oh, certainly. And it's pretty scary when you think about it.
Right.
But I think perhaps, you know, when everyone says, well, why hasn't this happened 100 times? It was a serendipity. It was you need to have certain environmental conditions. And who knows, maybe in the past we'd had birds or people, you know, infected with West Nile coming to the United States. But it hadn't been the hottest summer we'd had on record in New York City. And we had very record high temperatures for weeks and weeks, and then we had a very severe storm with flooding, and that makes mosquito populations explode. And it was really, I think, bad luck. The weather was against us. We had a massive mosquito explosion. We had no mosquito control in New York City because it had never been a problem since the 1800s. And it was just one of those bad luck kind of things. If it had been a cold summer, maybe nothing would have happened. The ability of a mosquito to transmit virus is critically temperature dependent. Last summer was a pretty cold and wet summer, and we didn't have as many cases as we had the previous one.
Right. Then the second thing is a selfish point. I handle and many wild birds a year.
Yeah, well, I'm going to stick my neck out on this one. And since the virus was identified, and as the pathologist who did all the postmortems at the zoo and demonstrated with immunohistochemical staining that there's a tremendous amount of virus in the tissues of these birds, I have been asking since this happened what the potential risk might be to people. There are 18 laboratory documented infections of West Nile under BL3 conditions, meaning there's no mosquito in sight. Aerosol transmission has been published. The recommendations that the CDC put out is that people take universal precautions. That means masks and gloves. And
while working with netting and trapping wild birds.
Yes. And maybe is that overkill? Well, I'd rather a little overkill and being conservative with taking precautions than having someone get killed.
Okay, and I can call who or what website to find out what types of masks work?
If you go, like I said, the best websites, if you go to the USDA.gov website, they'll have, you know, extensive information on West Nile in animals. If you go to USGS for United States
Geological
Service, USGS.gov, they also have an extensive West Nile database, and so does the CDC. And basically, you know, we wear our masks and gloves with everything, and I would urge you to take similar precautions because we know this virus is shed through the kidneys and the intestinal tract. It has been recovered on cloacal swabs, and tests are being performed now to try and establish how important a route of transmission that might be.
I don't want to die, and I don't want dead graduate students. So
very, very good point. I know. No one wants to die for science. I say the same thing.
Thanks for the call. Another champagne burst, and this is line three. Hello.
Yes. Let's just say a hypothetical question. One finds a crow, wings outstretched, just like it fell from the air and died, and the carcass has been there for, say, 3 weeks or so. Is it possible to detect any of the virus, I mean, at that point?
3 weeks, probably not. 5 days, we've had pretty good success demonstrating with PCR and immunohistochemical staining viral antigen, even in autolyzed specimens. But 3 weeks, no, I'd say that's pretty too far gone.
It's even safe to handle the carcass probably at that point, right?
Oh, yeah, I would think so, because it would have undergone complete autolysis.
Okay, so in other words, we're safe if we wait long enough, right?
Yeah, if you wait long enough. But, you know, the recommendations that have been used in the East is if you see dead birds and you want to submit them for testing, that you should pick them up through a plastic bag, not with your bare hands.
Yeah, okay. Well, thanks a lot. Then.
Sure.
All right. And we'll keep going here. Next will be, I think, line number one in Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, I know in an article on New Scientist last year, they thought the virus came from a bird imported from Israel, by which I take it they had some notion that the strain was similar to the one in Israel. But I wanted to ask you, isn't this an even worse disaster for, referring to the same article, isn't this a worse disaster for, like, South America? Because in this article, this fellow back in July of last year was saying that he thought the West Nile virus is probably in every corner of North America already, and though that the outbreaks he was expecting what were in the Gulf Coast, the next outbreaks. But apparently, from what I gather, he's saying that
The article by John Rapole?
Yes,
right. He also predicted that West Nile would spread south last summer. And in fact, it went north along the Hudson and up to the Canadian border before it spread south. Basically, we know so little about bird migrations. We know so little, and there are so many factors that are involved in how this disease may be spread. I think it's nice to make predictions, but will they hold up? No one knows. I don't think it's throughout the United States yet, because I think you would have seen fatality in horses, if not in birds. I mean, given the fact that our surveillance system is going to be quite variable state to state, people do have pet horses, and it would be seen if it got into an area that had horses. I'm quite certain of that. And from what we've seen in New York, you're going to have a spike in cases of encephalitis in people. So even if people aren't out there looking for dead birds, I think there will be indicators that we have a problem.
But if it did manage to get down to the Gulf Coast,
oh yeah, this could be devastating. That's why we're working on a vaccine.
I mean, it would probably go into South America. I mean, Central America and then South America as well, wouldn't it?
Oh sure.
Yeah, and that would be devastating down there.
Yes, it could be. It could be, and we really. Many species of birds are susceptible to this virus.
Yeah, and since they have tropical conditions,
Yes, that's been the question all along. What happens when this virus goes further south where mosquitoes are a year-round problem? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, thanks.
Okay, and to another caller, line two. This is Champagne. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
I have a dog that loves investigating dead birds, and is there any health threat to dogs and what would the symptoms be?
Oh, you know, no one can give you a scientific answer to that at this point. However, I will say that at last week's International West Nile Symposium, Dr. Bob McLean from the National Wildlife Health Center announced that he was able to successfully infect and kill crows by feeding them infected mice. So, oral transmission of the virus occurred from mice to crows. We have no idea whether that applies to other species, but I do everything I could to discourage my dog from doing that.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
All sure.
Right.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that because we're here at the end of the time, but I do, again, want to tell people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you're interested in hearing more on this subject from our guest, Tracy McNamara, she'll be giving a talk in the MillerCom series looking at the West Nile virus as a wake-up call for veterinary and public health preparedness. That's in room 180, Bevere Hall, on the U of I campus today at 4 o'clock. Tracy McNamara works for the Wildlife Conservation Society in New York City. She's a veterinary pathologist. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.